Welcome to episode 35 of Teachers Lift. Today, our hosts, Tess Hoag and Thomas Chan, are mixing things up and speaking with Mark Hopkins, who leads the third language team at CLE at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. Their conversation focuses on some of the challenges of implementing a meaningful third language program for university students, the relationship between third language acquisition and general academic performance, and the potential for teaching additional third languages to address the needs of increasingly international student cohorts. Now I'll turn it over to them. Have a great show, you guys.
Thanks for being here. And who are we at the moment? We've got Mark here, Mark Hopkins. We have Thomas Chan, and then we have myself, Tess Hoag. And so I would like to introduce everyone to Mark Hopkins, who's currently working at Hong Kong University of Science and Technology in the Center for Language Education, just as myself and Thomas Chan are. So what I want to say about you is that most of us have standard degrees. You have a particularly interesting background. You have an MA in modern and medieval languages, a diploma in translation, and in addition to working with students, you know, on their English proficiency, like the rest of us, you also teach French and you're involved in Spanish, as you run the Spanish Corner, which is the informal language practice group. I could go on, but I mean, who better than yourself to lead us into the theme for today, which is third language acquisition. So I'm wondering, Mark, is third language a bit of a misnomer? Because after all, most of our students already have three languages, don't they? Cantonese, Putonghua, and English. It seems to be the standard in Hong Kong. But we'll go on and we will talk about third language experience. And in your experience, what are the main reasons that students want to learn a Romance language?
Good question. I did think about this a little bit. When I asked them in the first lesson or so, they usually tell me it's interest. I try to give them the options. I say, well, you know, it could be for pragmatic reasons. You could maybe think of it as a stepping stone to a career. Even in Hong Kong, you know, plenty of French companies, French banks, startups. Some of them have got interesting gaming. Some of them have played Assassin's Creed. Some of them know about, you know, French tech. But a lot of them, and I have to say, because the courses I've been teaching since, earlier than this, but since about 2011, they've been compulsory for global business students. Many of the students are business students, and they tend to be, in our University of Science and Technology, more female students, and they're attracted by, you know, the romance of it. French teachers sometimes call it the three Fs: food, fashion, football. I don't know whether it's more the fashion for the girls or the food, but it's the language. They often say they love listening to the language. They like watching French movies and listening to French songs. So it's more interest, I would suppose, although there is an element of you know, having it on your CV. It looks good on your CV. And of course, there are opportunities to use it professionally in Hong Kong. Not many, but there are. That's French anyway.
As Tess mentioned, so most of our students are we would consider them almost trilingual. So they have a native, let's say, native Chinese, Cantonese, then they learn English, then they may learn Putonghua. Then they would often, in let's say, choose a fourth language. So do you think this has this idea of choice, let's say, because most of them, they were required by the curriculum to learn the three languages prior. This idea of choice, does that have an influence on their motivation towards the learning that language and their, let's say, their performance in the classroom as well?
Oh, great question, Thomas.
Yeah. Well, of course, they're all elective courses. I mean, the courses in third languages at UST and in other institutions, apart from, you know, those students who are taking degrees in European languages, there are only a couple of universities where that's possible in Hong Kong. So the choice is crucial factor. I mean, they're there because they want to be, and that's good. Wish we could say that for all our students in our English courses. But going back to your point, Tess, about, you know, definition, I mean, L3 is always the third language after your mother tongue, and in these days, globally these days, usually English. So when we talk about our students learning, for example, a Romance language, as you did, it is still considered to be their third language, because Cantonese Putonghua is their mother tongue, and then English is their language of utility. The French call it a vehicular language. It's a language which gets you places.
Yes, yes.
And it's essential, you know, for getting a good job in Hong Kong. So after that, you get the options. You get Japanese, of course, you get Spanish, you get French, you get German. Yeah.
Ah, well, as you know, we're presently conducting classes on Zoom. I don't know about your experience about that, but in terms of, you know, the differences in teaching our regular EAP students and then teaching a third language online, what would you say are the challenges or differences?
Well, it's all about language level, really, because we know that our students' English, their academic English, English is their second language. They're learning to a much higher level. They're already fairly fluent in English, intermediate, upper intermediate level. Teachers conduct all the Zoom classes and the traditional face-to-face classes entirely in English, whereas most students that choose an elective third language choose it as beginners. We don't tend to offer higher level courses because we don't have the numbers. So inevitably, the students need a language in which they can learn the third language. And then the question comes, is it better? Is it more useful, relevant to them to have, for example, necessary grammar explanations in their first language, in Chinese, Cantonese, or in English? And of course, as a teacher of French myself, but not able to give grammatical explanations in Cantonese, I don't have the choice. But there are some teachers in Hong Kong, some third language teachers, who might. And that's what interests me, that they could perhaps be using the student's first language or even the student's second language. But as for the extra challenges of doing it on Zoom, it's back to the challenges of doing anything on Zoom. On Zoom, you don't get the same level of interaction, same quality of interaction. And interaction is essential for language practice, particularly at lower levels. You know, they need to practice the basic vocabulary and structures of a new language, and it's harder to set that up.
That's for sure. Sometimes
face-to-face classroom.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to just be able to hear, hear the sounds on Zoom.
Let alone practice pronunciation. I mean, you know, modeling pronunciation. Yeah. Is fine for the teacher who's fully prepared, but getting responses from the students, some of whom might still be wearing masks because they're in public areas when they're taking the class.
Oh my gosh, that must be really tough.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I just tell them you have to find a quiet area. You have to take your mask off, otherwise I can't hear whether you're making the nasal vowel sounds correctly.
Ah, now that's an interesting challenge, because of course we don't have that when we're teaching our classes. I've never, thought of telling a student, oh, you have to take off your mask or find a place.
Well, if you're focusing on pronunciation, yeah. I would say it's pretty essential.
Yeah.
really hard otherwise.
Well, I mean, that I know that this is an area that particularly interests Thomas, and I know he's raring to ask you about this. And that is the idea of... whether they draw more on their L2 language, which is English, in order to learn a Romance language. And I think the answer is quite obvious to me, but maybe Thomas, you could articulate that a little better.
Yeah, so as you mentioned about this idea of perhaps we could call it a concept of, let's say, a pathway. So we know that our students, they have our students in Hong Kong, at least, they follow, let's say, a regular pathway where they first have their mother tongue in Chinese, then they learn English afterwards. So would it be more ideal for them to learn a third language similar to English, or does it have no real influence? Could they just pick any other language?
Oh, it's an interesting question, and that's yeah, the one I've been thinking about a lot recently. I mean, we've got to see the reality as it is, that our students are not going to either want to or have the opportunity to learn a language other than English as their second language after their mother tongue, Chinese Cantonese. English is the global language. It is the dominant language internationally, and Hong Kong is an international city.
I think the French would disagree with you there.
Oh, they wouldn't actually. No, they've pretty much accepted it. For example, the French Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong holds most of its meetings in English.
But it
frustrates the Alliance Française, who are promoting the French language in Hong Kong. But the reality is that the international language of business is English.
Yes, so, although we still hear French at the Olympic Games.
Are there a few, we could call them historical relics? Yeah,
that's right.
I remember the 2008 Olympic Games. I was teaching French at the time, or maybe just before that, or just after that. But maybe it was a summer course I was teaching. The Olympic Games were going on in 2008 in Beijing. And it was interesting to me that I would hear the results announced in Chinese, French, English, or sometimes in that order even. And some of my students at the time were curious about that. So, you know, a little digression into the history of the setting up of the Olympic Games and the Olympic Committee and their regulations and everything. Yeah, there are a few. You might still, if you use snail mail, you might see an airmail sticker on an envelope and see that it's still written in French.
Yes,
for some reason.
That's right.
The International Postal Union still uses English and French. The EU, though, even without the UK as part of it, even with the native English speakers in the European Union representing only, I think, something now like 6% of the population, basically Ireland and Malta, are still using English in 90% of their meetings. So, you know, it's just a reality. So coming back to French, and coming back to your question, Thomas, because whenever a student in Hong Kong is going to be learning a third language like French, Spanish, perhaps not Japanese, but French, Spanish, and other European languages, German, etc., they will be learning that with the background of having learned English. And most studies these days suggest that it would be silly to ignore. You can't ignore, in fact.
Of course.
You can leverage, you can use it. You can use that prior linguistic knowledge of a language in a similar language family. And of course, then you would argue, well, okay, is English a Romance language? Probably not. It's mostly a Germanic language, but it's still an Indo-European language, which Chinese is not.
So should we be encouraging them to follow this pathway then, given that this prior knowledge, and wouldn't it be a waste if they were to just, let's say, switch to another language and then learn everything over again after having learned all those structures from the second language of English?
Well, there's a certain amount that can be carried over, that can be transferred, but a lot can't. I mean, vocabulary is one case in French and Spanish where a lot can be transferred, but the grammatical system is quite different between French and English. So you can't just say, well, you know, we're going to just base this on English grammar. We're going to base our learning of French on English grammar. Now, that's a kind of, I can understand I can understand your question, but the point is that there are enough aspects in the process of having learned English, even psychological aspects, the experience of having achieved something, the little skills all good language learners acquire, that mean that learners of third languages are actually demonstrably better than bilinguals. And then when they go on to learn a fourth or a fifth language, they pick it up even faster. And of course, it helps when they're in the same language family, but it isn't a requirement. They are actually, there's quite a lot of evidence to show that they're actually better at learning any other fourth, fifth, sixth language once they're trilingual, once they've had the experience of learning three languages. So our students have got a great foundation, an amazing foundation, as you said at the beginning, being already trilingual.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly sounds like it. How much do they actually meet up to their expectations? Because I remember you were saying right at the beginning about how they're interested in doing in learning French, perhaps because they want to join a French company. But nevertheless, your language skills need to be quite high in order to operate successfully in a French company. So do many of them continue on to an intermediate or advanced level, or do they often just sort of stop at a basic level of language proficiency?
I think I'd have to admit that most of them do stop at an elementary level after a course or two. Yeah, I think that's the most common profile.
But, and what would be the reason for that? Would that be that perhaps, well, I'll let you answer the question.
Opportunity yes. in UST. And then obviously I do advise them to go on to the Alliance Française. But, you know, for some of them, it's the traveling, it's the expense, you know, it's the motivation. And then they're very busy, as we know. They have their own major, which is at UST going to be nothing to do with language.
Mm.
Well, there's a pool of languages.
I see. So we've been talking quite a bit about French, but we haven't mentioned Spanish. And of course, you and I are on the Spanish corner, El Rincón, right?
Could I give a bit of background to those groups? Because they
That'd be great.
Please go ahead.
Once we started teaching credit-bearing courses in 4-5 languages in around about 2011, then there had been a French conversation group that I'd run for even years before that. But over the last 10 years, Spanish, German, and Japanese groups have been set up and run with the help of very, very, very enthusiastic postgraduate students. In one case, a
Amazing.
Faculty member from the School of Humanities has helped out with the Japanese group, all native speakers. And the group numbers have ranged between, well, up to sometimes more than 20, but usually around a dozen. So we keep them small, intimate. They're weekly groups. So, you know, when you get a dozen people, 14, 16, coming every week, well, you know, you attended a few of them, Tess, right? Of course,
yes, the Spanish
that was prior
one.
To COVID. Yeah, yeah.
Of course.
But you
yeah.
attended a few of the sessions, and you know that each session we'd have a different topic, we'd have a different person running it. The facilitator, the postgrad, would handle that very well. I would be there to maybe help with maybe the occasional clarification, but usually the students themselves would be doing it. I think they'd be very successful. Yeah.
Yeah, because the thing that really impressed me was that. You know, despite some lower levels of proficiency, the students don't seem to have the same hesitation as they do with English. For example, in our classes, you know, often if you ask a question, students will remain silent. They don't want to particularly stand out. They may have some hesitancy in expressing themselves in English. And yet, even in this is what I noticed in the Spanish corner group, even if their levels were pretty low, they would just keep trying and trying and practice. So I think what that actually says is that they're not the same political and social overtones to them learning that language as opposed to English, which, as we said before, is a much more of a practical language for them. What do you think about that?
Possibly, or maybe just because it's not a must in their lives. I mean, they feel they can do as much or a little bit as they like. They're doing it out of interest, mostly.
Probably the idea of choice would definitely come in, right?
Like yes, Thomas said, they've chosen to be there, and this is not a course. This is not something affecting their GPA.
But well, yes, exactly. So what I was saying really, or trying to emphasize, is how much more confident they are in making mistakes, expressing themselves, in comparison to English, where they're more guarded about making mistakes, you know, when they're speaking.
I think the context is the key though, there, because
yes,
we're talking about
exactly.
small group discussions facilitated by their peers effectively, or maybe people just a little bit older than them, with native speakers who are also of their age. I mean, this is a model I know that we've been trying as well for English with ILANG activities. Thomas, you could give a bit of background to that, right? Because not that many years ago, you were on the front line of that. Yeah.
Part of the iLang team. Basically, the iLang team, we provide extracurricular activities for students, of course, non-credit bearing or by choice they choose to come and to improve their English. So we provide immersive activities so they could join, let's say, a group of friends, and they would hang out together outside of class and just do what friends do, but purely in English. Or they could join another type of class where they learn various skills needed in English, like how to disagree appropriately. So these are, again, extracurricular. And I would say I would agree that, yes, these students do seem a bit more motivated in these type of classes rather than the traditional EAP classes. So the question is, how do we get that into an EAP class then? So we know that these type of students exist and they can be motivated in that way, but how do we get them to feel the same in our EAP classes?
Oh, that's a tough question, isn't it? Yeah. But definitely it shows that there's still space for a kind of parallel informal curriculum, because although it won't be attracting 100% of our students, maybe at the most 20%, we know that this self-selecting, highly motivated 20% of students, the same kinds of students that are interested in learning a third language, Spanish, French, Japanese, would also be uninhibited about making mistakes in English, because you know they'd be happy to come along to these informal activities and discussion groups and chat sessions. You know?
Does personality come into this? Would we say that those type of students are more, let's say, the extroverted versus introverted? Do you think personality has an influence?
I would say studious, driven, and possibly quite introverted students in some of my group. I say my groups. I mean the third language groups over the years. I'm thinking particularly of the German group, where I had a few guys, male students, that stayed in the German group from freshman year right up until after they graduated, and even maybe some of them perhaps continued with a master's degree. So 4 to 5 years. They were never particularly willing to talk. The facilitator was great. She was amazing. She would bring everything down to their level, even though often she didn't have a lot of interest in the kind of things they were interested in, you know, sort of a group of male engineering students. But the motivation for them was to improve their German. So they came along regular as clockwork every Tuesday evening or whatever it was. And, you know, they were interested in grammar, and they weren't especially extroverts. I wouldn't characterize all the kinds of students that are looking for language practice activities as extroverts by any means. They want so many different things. They're all individuals, basically. And so that's the great thing in small group discussions, that you can cater for these individuals. I think that's the crux of the dilemma in the classroom, as you were saying, Tess, that, you know, you just don't have the time or the space when you have 20. And on Zoom, I would say it's nearly impossible.
Oh, for sure. You know? So what would you define small group? Would that be about 6 to 10 students?
Yeah, 10, 12 maybe. Yeah, 14 at the maximum, perhaps. Yeah, I said we've been very lucky, because that's been the kind of core of all our third language conversation groups over the years. It's never really been much over 14. When the Japanese group got too big, I recommended it split into two. But then after a few weeks, there's the natural attrition. Some students sign up at the beginning of the semester, but after 3 or 4 weeks, they find they haven't got time for it. So it shrunk back down to one biggish group. But the French, German, and Spanish groups, as you saw, Tess, were only ever a dozen or so. The biggest.
That's right.
Yeah, and it was fine in the seminar room. It worked really well. Putting the responsibility on them to choose the curriculum, really. I mean, what topics they wanted discussed during the semester, but giving enough notice for the facilitator, in some cases myself, to actually prepare some kind of backup. So, for example, extra vocabulary on that topic.
Oh, perhaps. So the students pick the topic that they wanted to learn.
Yes, they pick the topics, but they're not language topics. They're content topics. So, for example, if they want to talk about Formula One in German, or if they want to talk about ice hockey in French, that's what they do. And we've had that over the years. We've had a huge range of of topics related to sports, hobbies, interests. Festivals are always popular because they're just so curious by the fact that Europeans have so many public holidays, some of them connected to, you know, Christian tradition festivals, you know.
I think we have a lot of public holidays.
But they're different in Hong Kong, aren't they? You know?
Yeah, really.
They want to know what carnival is. They want to know how the French celebrate Christmas, or the Spanish, the Semana Santa, you know, the
yes. Easter. Yes.
So there's a lot you can culturally, there's a lot you can bring to these groups. Especially, of course, if you have the help from native speaker facilitators.
Actually, we've got this far, and I realized we haven't actually asked you, and I'd be interested to know about you too, Thomas. But what languages would you say you speak, to some level of fluency?
Okay, well, I was brought up speaking English and French. I'm dual national. I studied German at university, at school, of course, and then university, but never got completely fluent, which is why I was always so happy to go along to the German groups and to be a participant observer, if you like, really, in the German groups. I lived in Southeast Asia for several years, and so my Malay is pretty good, but that's about it. I'm just very curious about the other languages that you find so much easier. So this is my interest in what I call L3. In my case, it's called L4, L5. But like, for example, I remember, well, I still do have the experience of being able to understand quite a lot of Tagalog from the Spanish and Malay that I know. Sorry, I forgot.
If you combine
I lived in Spain and my Spanish, as you know, Tess, is kind of maybe B2A, B2C1. I mean, actually, someone told me it was higher than that, but it's I lived in Spain for a couple of years, but you know, with Spanish and Malay, you can actually understand Tagalog.
Or if you actually, I think you would understand Chavacano more, because Chavacano's down south.
No, I have a friend who's doing some research into that. That's a fascinating case study down in Zamboanga.
I met
some Chavacano speakers when I was last in East Malaysia in Sabah, and yeah, there was no problem at all communicating with them. It was very weird. In closer to home now, I mean, I find I'm kind of very interested in learning Portuguese and Italian. And I'm curious as to why I can understand Italian, but I can't understand Portuguese. My Portuguese friends tell me I should go to Brazil. I'd understand the Portuguese there perfectly. But once you do have a couple of languages in the same language family, exactly like our students, this is what I tell our students, you know, this is why for mainlanders coming to Hong Kong, they if they make a little effort, they can pick up Cantonese fairly fast. And why for most Hong Kongers, they have a fairly good passive knowledge of Putonghua without really trying.
Absolutely right.
So it's just that, you know, the language typology, as we were talking about, or, you know, we thought we might comment on, and of course the proximity of these languages and dialects that makes it so much easier. And it's a great confidence booster.
Yeah, and but it's interesting what you say about Portuguese, because I used to find Portuguese quite, you know, difficult to understand, but Italian was okay.
Italian's much easier, isn't it?
Yeah, but now I can understand Portuguese, because my language background is a bit strange. My native language is English, but I didn't actually learn English until I was six. Mm-hmm. So my first language was Korean. Then I forgot Korean, and then we moved to Italy, and then my next language was Italian. So I remember going back to Australia and not being able to understand anyone. And then I was learning, we left after a year, and then I started learning Spanish at the same time as I was continuing to learn English. So I would say with my language background, of course, English, Spanish, I got a good grasp of French and Italian, because I learned both languages, and I've also had to communicate in them with both of them. German, because I had to study German mainly for my singing, and then so this is what I'm getting to. And then Portuguese was once I started singing Bossa Nova, and I started having to learn the pronunciation. Then you key into certain key sounds, And then you realize out of all the languages, Portuguese is the closest to Spanish, at least when you read it. But when it's pronounced, then I had to learn how to pronounce it because of, you know, my singing. So, and then of course I got, I also have Indonesian since I studied and also lived in Indonesia. And then Tagalog, which is my mother's language.
So very similar range of languages, the two of us, actually.
Yeah, so we're sort of...
Lots of overlapping.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
Spanish, Malay, French,
German. I would say my Indonesian is a lot better than my Tagalog. I find it a much easier language. And what about you, Thomas? What are your languages?
Yeah, it's really interesting, I think, because... So I would say that my L1 or my native is English, despite my parents both... having Cantonese as their native, but I was born in the UK and it's the environment I grew up in. And then my second language would probably be Cantonese, but I've never actually been taught explicitly how to speak Cantonese. I just picked it up in the environment as well. And then my L3 I would consider to be Putonghua, which I did study extensively in both high school and in junior school as well. But the interesting thing is I can't remember anything about Putonghua, despite having studied it for almost 10 plus years. I know just the basics, but then that's it. So in terms of writing, I'm completely forgotten. Yeah, rereading I can still read some words, but I've found that my writing is I can barely string a few sentences together, despite having studied it for all this time.
Cantonese and Putonghua or
Cantonese is spoken is okay, I would say, but then not to a native extent. But I find it's the writing which is I know nothing about it, despite having learned how to write many different characters. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well,
yes,
well we're certainly a mixed bunch, aren't we?
Yeah, the comment there from Levi, I just completely agree with you, of course, Levi, and that there has been some evidence. In fact, the papers that you
well, actually, just to fill you in, what Levi says is, and Levi, by the way, everyone, he's sitting in, Levi Lam, and he said, just curious, any evidence that correlates polyglot with improved general academic performance? And now, Mark, your answer.
Well, my answer was simply to say that yeah, I mean, since Cummings and the Canadians back in I'm talking about Lambert, of course, but one of the papers that you attach remind me of that. Since the studies with both French and English speaking Canadians back in the 70s and 80s. There's been quite a lot of research. I mean, you know, even in Hong Kong, students with a third language, with potentially a fourth language, are much, much better at learning new languages. Whether that correlates also with, generally speaking, improved academic skills, problem solving, for example. I would say that one of the characteristics of good language learners, I mean, successful language learners, as we've been talking about. I mean, okay, three of us, perhaps we should tap ourselves on the back a little bit because, you know, we're in this category, is that we're not too afraid to take risks. We don't mind making mistakes. We've had to inevitably transit between different cultures and languages at different times in our lives. And that's put us in sometimes rather awkward positions where we've stood out from the monolingual background. I'm thinking of you, Thomas, in the UK, perhaps at some point, but certainly Tess, from the account you gave of your linguistic history. It's my experience too. And that if you negotiate that successfully, if you come out with another language in your backpack, kind of, and you move on, then you've had to take risks, you've had to be adaptable. I think these are all skills that generally could help you academically, could help you with study skills and make you a better learner of other subjects. But there's definitely evidence that it makes you a better learner of further languages, if you're L4, L5, L6. There's no doubt about that.
It probably also changes the way that we think or view the world, because there's certainly there's something to how your personality changes, or how you know, when you speak another language. So for example, when I'm speaking in Spanish, I find that I'm naturally more vivacious. The kind of language that I use is more emotional as well, because as we know, in Spanish or the Romance languages, when you greet people, it's often very effervescent, right?
Absolutely.
But then when you revert back to English, it's more of a neutral language, not so much emotional responses. But I don't know, maybe.
Well, philosophers and writers have over the years have said things to the effect that, you know, a person with just one language is just one window on the world, one door. You know, it's like walking down a corridor, and the more languages you have, the more doors are open to you. And they've gone further. They've actually said, of course, this is a great thing for us to say to our Hong Kong students, because none of them are in this category, almost none of the students that we teach, is that monolingualism is actually a disease. Famously mentioned by the Finnish linguist, Skutlab Kangas, who I remember meeting years and years ago. It is a disease, but fortunately it can be cured quite easily. Just learn another language. You have to feel sorry for students in indeterminately monolingual countries, monolingual education systems, where second languages are not even taught very well. I'm thinking of the UK, Australia, and some parts of the United States, you know, where actually people don't learn a language in high school or middle school. They certainly don't learn it in primary school anymore, in elementary school.
What do you think are the reasons for that, though?
Political, I mean, economic, but basically it's the hegemony of English. I mean, you know, English is a killer language. It's killed so many languages around the world. Of course, it's a great tool. It's the tool of globalization. It's the medium of globalization, but it's massacred languages around the world.
Well, it's also the language of colonialism.
Well, yes. Other colonial powers tried to impose their languages as well, just they were less successful. No, it's obviously, a kind of neo-colonialism. It's economic colonialism. It's the West, basically, the United States. And I don't want to just focus on them, because like I said, the EU now, their working language is mainly English. You know, and yet that goes against the very principles of their foundation, which was diversity.
That's certainly a step in the wrong direction, isn't it?
Well, there's a bit of a pushback from some of the MEPs, that, especially from countries like France and Spain. They're trying to push back Italy as well. But a lot of Northern European countries and their populations already quite comfortable using English as this kind of vehicular language, as I mentioned, the French call it. Some people also question whether the standard of the documents may not be dropping a little bit, because they're often redacted in the second language of the delegates. So they're not using the facilities of translation interpreting, which of course are very, very expensive, because you think of the number of combinations of possible languages within a 27 country political unit. You know, they're no longer taking advantage of the fact that you can have a translation from Greek into Maltese if you want, because both the Greek and the Maltese delegates are prepared to just talk to each other in English and work on the same document in English. It's quicker, it saves money, but then perhaps there's a loss of content, a loss of quality along the way somewhere.
It's all basically down to practicality.
Dumbing down, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that I've noticed, although it's not very academic, my comment, but Netflix. On Netflix, there used to be a lot of European movies or series in their original languages. And now I've noticed that what they're doing is they're producing films or series in English. But they it really loses a lot because for some reason the language is stiltered. It looks like it's bad acting, but I realize it was actually bad language. There's a lot lost in translation.
That might be another example of the same phenomenon.
Yeah. So I'd rather hear it in the original language.
Of course. And of course, there was the distinction always made in Europe between countries, between the education systems of countries where foreign TV series were regularly dubbed compared to countries where the foreign TV series were regularly subtitled. You must know this yourself, Tess. The difference between learning English in Spain and Portugal was that if you learned English in Portugal, when you switched on the TV, when you come home from school, you could watch a number of English language TV programs subtitled into Portuguese, but you'd still be listening to English in the evenings. Whereas in Spain, you would come
Everything is dubbed into Spanish.
Yeah. I remember the challenge when I first lived in Spain and my Spanish wasn't really that good. And I love going to the movies. And of course, they didn't have English subtitles. Why would they have English subtitles in a Spanish cinema? And all the films, even the latest release Hollywood films, had been dubbed into Spanish. And I went along half hoping that some of them might be in the original English with Spanish subtitles. I eventually found an art house cinema in the city, in a bigger city nearby where I was living, where they did do that. But nearly all movies and TV programs were just dubbed. Same issue in Northern Europe. Because, you know, France, in the past, most TV series were dubbed. They're not anymore. Yes. But in Germany and Scandinavian countries, they were never dubbed. They were always subtitled. Actually, I'm not so sure about Germany, but the Netherlands and Scandinavian countries, they were always subtitled, which gave them a head start.
Yes. No, I agree. I definitely remember that experience in Spain. Everything is just dubbed. In Spanish, and that not only that, it's always the same voices. Six people who are doing the dub. So, no matter what you watch, you always. I think we're coming towards the end of our wonderful chat, and I was wondering if there's anything that you wanted to add, Thomas or Mark, to our discussion. Particularly back onto L3 issues, I imagine.
Yeah, so maybe we could ask Mark for his final takeaways on what can we learn from this idea of L3 that we can take back into the L2 classroom or the EAP classroom. If there's one final tip you could give.
Well, basically, L3 is all about choice, as you said, Thomas. It's about diversity, about individualization, about the individual's experience of learning a language. If we could somehow try to ensure that we're all student-centered in our teaching approaches, but if we catered for individual different learning styles, and individual interests too. I mean, Why are students learning English? Well, actually, they'll just say that they're there because they have to be, because it's important in Hong Kong, it's an international city, to get a good job. But they could have other interests. They could be using it as a way to communicate with people from other languages and cultures. For example, if we're in the fortunate situation of having some non-Chinese students in our groups, we do in UST have quite a lot of students from other Asian countries, so South Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and also from Korea, from Indonesia. It's very, very good. It's very inspiring to hear the first steps at attempts to communicate about what the students themselves are interested in between, for example, native speakers of Chinese and these other speakers of other Asian languages, which they have to do in English. We need to facilitate that. That's what we do in a third language classroom. We're looking to make links, making links between the second language and the third language. And of course, not to say that there are no links between the first language and the third language, but very often between the second language, because that's going to be English, and the third language they're learning if it's a European language, and try to encourage them to think about what they're doing all the time, kind of reflective approach to to language learning, which understands linguistic diversity.
Yeah. Well, fantastic point. And also Levi is echoing the same sentiment. He's also saying it's a great point. Well, Thomas, anything you'd like to add before we finish up?
I'd just like to thank Mark for all his great insights from today. Yes.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. I mean, it's great. I really do enjoy listening to the Teachers Lift podcast, and hopefully a few people will listen to this one.
And now you can listen to yourself.
Are you part of it?
I hate listening to myself. It's like watching myself on Zoom afterwards.
I know, isn't it terrible? All right, well, thank you very much, and I think we'll finish up now.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Teacher's Lift. This podcast is a collaborative effort from the Center for Language Education at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, the Center for Applied English Studies at the University of Hong Kong, and the English Language Center at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. We appreciate that you've taken the time to listen today. If you've enjoyed this show and you want to be notified when new episodes are published, please be sure to subscribe with the podcasting app of your choice. Of course, we also always appreciate when you can like and subscribe on Facebook or any of those other social media platforms. It sure helps us to get the word out. Until next time, stay cool out there, everybody. It is sweltering out there. Thanks. Bye-bye.